This is White Collared, the podcast, season 2, episode 11, Forging Bonds. I would like to thank you for joining me in another episode of White Collared, the podcast, which is a retrospective commentary on the USA Network television series, White Collar. My name is Eric Altenglenn Hilliard. There are no announcements for this episode, so let's just get straight into it. Forging Bonds first aired on January 25th, 2010. It was written by Alexandra McNally and Jeff Easton, directed by John T. Kretschmer. Peter and Neil have learned that Vincent Adler is the man behind the schemes surrounding the music box and Kate's death. But who exactly is Vincent Adler, and what is the connection between him and Neil? That is the question in Peter's mind as he looks through information about Adler. The question looms even larger in his mind when, during his research into Adler, Peter sees a photo of Neil and Adler together. This episode is a little bit different in that the modern day story that's being told is actually just the framework for what we might call an origin story. It is the story of how Neil and Mozzie got together and their relationship with Vincent Adler. Consequently, most of the story is Neil retelling past events to Peter, and we see those events as they unfold. But to begin with, we see Peter researching Adler. We learn that Adler was the suspected person behind a billion-dollar Ponzi scheme, and that he disappeared, seemingly without a trace. And we, along with Peter, learn that Neil had a direct connection to Adler when Peter sees a photo of Neil with Adler. Peter then shows up at Neil's apartment and asks Neil, if you knew him, why didn't you say anything about him? And why didn't you say anything about him being behind all the turmoil with Kate in the music box? Neil says he only just figured it out and that he's having trouble reconciling the Adler he knew with the man responsible for Kate's death and Mozzie's shooting. Peter says, okay, well then, let's get him. Tell me everything you know about him. He'd shown up with a sack of groceries, and out of that sack he pulls some beer for himself and wine for Neil. Neil balks at the wine, saying that he doesn't recognize the bottle, and then sarcastically noting that, as he puts it, he doesn't even need a corkscrew because the wine has a screw top. It would seem that Neil is a bit of a wine snob. Now, corks have been the preferred choice for closing wines since the beginning of modern Europe in the 1400s. Cork oak bark was and still is one of the few natural products that is malleable enough to hold the contents inside of a glass bottle. And when cut slightly larger than the opening and forced in, the cork expands to provide a tight seal that prevents air from getting in and the liquid that's in from getting out. Now, because cork is a tree bark, it can dry out and lose its elasticity. Therefore, bottles can be safely stored on their side, which keeps the wine against the cork, the interior pieces of the cork, and keeps it moist and helps keep it from drying and contracting. Cork is a flexible product and does have some advantages. It's a natural product and it is a renewable resource. That's the good news. The downsides to cork is that, on average, it takes a tree 25 years to grow to the dimensions that are required in order to be able to harvest its bark, and then it's an additional 9 to 12 years before a usable harvest is produced. While it is a renewable resource, it is still a natural resource and therefore is subject to all the rules of the natural world. It can fall victim to blight, fire, and other environmental factors can also pose risks to the cork trees and cork production. Another problem with cork is that the majority of the world's cork is grown in Portugal. So essentially, an entire industry depends on a single source for an essential component. This is risky both from a production availability standpoint and the possible monopolistic pricing standpoint. Also, because cork is a wood, it is both an organic material and it is a porous material, which means that it can absorb all sorts of other components. And cork is sometimes infected by a compound called 2,4-6-trichloranazole, which gives the wine an off smell. It's reminiscent of mustiness or new leather. And at minimum, this infection can dull the aromas and flavors of the wine, and at worst, it dominates the aromas and flavors. Estimates of the incidence of corked wines being infected or tainted is variable, but in the 1990s, when the problem was thought to be at its worst, it was widely accepted that about 1 in 10 or 12 bottles was affected. A test of 2,800 bottles by Wine Spectator in 2005 found that 7% were tainted, or about 1 bottle in 14. Now, whether the problem is as severe as many people estimate it to be or not, the allegations, along with shortages of good cork, gave impetus to the increase in alternate enclosures. For a while, it looked as if synthetic corks might be the wave of the future. And while you still can find synthetic corks around, they apparently never became as widespread as originally anticipated. The one great advantage of them is that they are inexpensive. They cost about 15 cents a piece. The downsides is that they can be hard to open and reseal. In fact, they are considered to be one of the hardest wine enclosures to open, and some can be virtually impossible to put back into the bottle once removed. Some wine professionals claim that they can detect a chemical odor in the wines with the oil-based plastic corks or artificial corks, particularly if the wine has been bottled for some time. While reports of these aromas have abated, apparently, in recent years, the potential for off odors still is a concern for some. Enter the screw cap. The main obstacle to the widespread use of screw caps on wine was, and continues to be, mostly consumer and industry resistance. The wine industry is steeped in tradition. Some might call it elitism. Although screw caps have been used sporadically since the 1930s for wine sealing, mainly they were used on cheap, mass-produced wines, and because of that, many people still believe that the screw cap sealed wines must be of low quality. Others argue that, no, it's the ritual. The removing of the cork is intrinsic to the enjoyment of the bottle of wine, and they believe that fine wines should be sealed with a cork. But more and more producers are moving to screw caps for their wines, and initially, they were used mostly in New World wines, but now wines from all over Europe can also be found with screw caps. The modern screw cap used for wines, it ain't your grandfather's screw cap. In the early 1960s, Australian winemaker Peter Well, who was the director of the South Australian winery Yalumba, I hope I pronounced that correctly, he got fed up with the large amount of tainted cork that they were getting for their wine bottle sealing and the subsequent loss of revenue as a result of the taint. He hired a French company to design an alternative enclosure, and with that, the Stelvin screw cap, designed specifically for wines, was born. Screw caps have a lot of pros and reportedly very few cons. On the pro side, you've got longevity, truer, more consistent expressions of the wine, cost and affordability, and of course, you don't need a wine opener. Side-by-side studies seem to be showing that the Stelvin-style screw cap can actually act to preserve and extend the lifespan of a wine in comparison to cork. Now, despite all these pros, there is still a great reluctance to move more fully into the screw cap world. And again, it mostly comes from tradition and perception. But over time, consumers in some countries, notably Scandinavia, Northern Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, have accepted screw caps on everyday wines. And in fact, the California Wine Club reports that 90% of New Zealand wineries and 70% of Australian wineries are now bottling using twist-off caps or twisties. In fact, even some of the most expensive and famous of those wines are sealed with screw caps. But the same triple-digit wines that are capped with Stelvins in those countries use cork when bottled for export to the U.S. Apparently, Americans are still somewhat elitist when it comes to wine and figure that a beverage that costs $150 should come with some sort of pomp and circumstance. I also mentioned cost. There is a benefit of using the Stelvin screw caps in that they cost about 25 cents a piece, while good quality natural cork can cost anywhere from 75 cents to $2 a cork. So being less expensive for the wineries, ultimately the screw caps are less expensive for the consumer. Back in 2015, James Lobb of Wine Spectator wrote, "Anyone who knew about California wine in the mid-1970s knew that the state made exceptional wines. What it lacked was respect. The same is true for twisties today." He calls twisties the best available option for ensuring the quality and consistency of wines. I suppose I should also mention one other thing here, and that is boxed wines. If you remember back in Book of Hours, Season 1, Episode 3, that Mozzie, after having examined the bottle that they were suspecting had a clue in it, Mozzie reported that he didn't find anything in the bottle, no clues in the bottle. The only thing he found were remnants of a very lovely boxed Franzia from early October. More and more everyday wines are coming out in the bag-in-a-box package. It's not necessarily well-suited for fine wine collecting or wines that you're going to allow to age in your cellar to improve. However, if you're talking about efficiency and a modest everyday wine that you might enjoy on a regular basis, it's hard to beat the advantages of this bag-in-a-box package. The box literally contains a bag. It's a shrinking Mylar bag that can hold up to 3 liters of wine. 3 liters is the equivalent of 4 bottles, and the box is much smaller in terms of the space required for storage. That means it's more efficient whether it's sitting on your refrigerator shelf, on your counter, or as it's being trucked to the store. When you open a bottle and pour out the wine, air fills the space that the wine leaves behind, and oxidation is the source of most wine spoilage once the bottle has been opened. On the other hand, the bag in a box does not allow any oxygen to come into contact with the wine. As the wine is poured out of the box, the bag shrinks to take up the space that had been previously occupied by the wine, which means that once the box has been opened and started to be used, the wine inside will last much longer before it spoils. Wine in a bottle generally lasts a few days. Wine in a box can last for up to 30 or 60 days without having any obvious negative impact from being opened. Generally speaking, the economies of scale, the recyclable aspect of the boxes, and the fact that they reduce the shipping weight of wine due to the replacement of heavy glass with lightweight cardboard all dramatically lead to a smaller carbon footprint. Additionally, because of the lower packaging and shipping costs, the prices are also significantly reduced in the boxes so that you can usually get the equivalent of 4 bottles of wine for the price of only 2 or 3. Back in the episode, Peter defends his wine choice, saying that the bottle of wine costs as much as his 6-pack of beer. So how much does a 6-pack of Heisler beer cost? I mean, after all, if that's the standard by which he's judging the quality of this wine, it only means something if we know what it costs. Well, Heisler is a fictitious beer. It is one of 40 different custom beer labels that a group called Studio Graphics, which is the in-house graphics team at the legendary Hollywood prop house Independent Studio Services, has created in the past 40 years. So, can't really get a good price comparison. But let's presume that Heisler is, let's say, more of a craft beer than a mass market beer. That being the case, $10 to $12 US for a 6-pack is probably a reasonable price. For wine, $10 to $12 for a bottle of wine isn't really high end. In fact, it's not even medium end. Is medium end a thing? It's not even what most people would call a moderately priced wine. But depending on the wine, it could be an acceptable everyday or table wine. After they discuss Peter's wine choices for Neil, Peter wants to find out everything Neil knows about Adler.
How do you know Adler? It's a long story. If we're going to catch this guy, just like I caught you, I need to know everything.
There's too much to tell.
I get it. This story includes some stuff about crimes I don't know about.
Yeah. No. You're not holding back on me. We've got all night.
I'll make you a deal. Full immunity for anything you say from this moment until the sun rises over that balcony.
Full immunity.
Did you kill anybody?
Nope.
Then full immunity.
Can Peter really promise Neil immunity? Laws undoubtedly vary by jurisdiction, but generally it seems that in most cases, law enforcement officers do not have the authority to grant immunity from prosecution. There's a caveat to that, though. It also generally seems that if a suspect is prosecuted based on confessions of a crime, confessions made based on promises of immunity made by law enforcement officers, those convictions are generally overturned on the grounds that the confession was not given of the suspect's own free will and therefore were in fact coerced. That doesn't mean that law enforcement is prohibited from using the confession as a roadmap to find the evidence that they need to enable the suspect to be prosecuted. It just means that the confession itself can't be used in the case. What this seems to indicate is that Peter really doesn't have the authority to make this promise to Neil. However, we know that Peter is generally a man of integrity and will not willingly reveal anything that Neil tells him. So even though he can't really promise it, he's going to keep it under his hat. Neil tells Peter that the music box code revealed a fractal and that he'd seen one before in Vincent Adler's office when he worked for him. Then Neil tells Peter that the Vincent Adler story starts with Mozzie. Neil begins recounting the story of him coming to New York and meeting Mozzie by first beating him and his partner at a Follow the Lady con, also known as Five Card Monty. Now, one of the first rules of Five Card Monty seems to be that the mark never wins a bet. Ever. The only people who win are shills. Because of the way that the cards are manipulated and the way the mark is mentally manipulated, the mark will rarely, if ever, pick the correct card. On the off chance that the mark does happen to pick the correct card, the shill bets more, and the dealer insists he can only take one bet at a time, and he has to take the bigger bet, thereby preventing the mark from winning, while also stoking the mark's belief that he really can beat the con, because if it hadn't been for this other guy placing a larger bet, he would have beat him. At least that's what he believes. So Neil beats the con about the only way he can. He probably intentionally picked the wrong card, knowing that the shill would not be compelled to outbet him, then using sleight of hand, replaced the losing card with an apparent winning card. And of course, when he turns over the queen in a place that Mozzie and his accomplice didn't expect, he was able to take advantage of their shock to pick up the money from the table. And although there are a vast number of variations in card design, not just the back, but the face as well, I gotta say it's surprising that he just happened to have a matching card from a matching set, save the color of the back. After having been beaten by Neil at Five Card Monty, Mozzie shows up at his door and wants to talk to him.
I'm the guy from the park.
Hey, I'm not here to give you hospital time, kid.
Good, because I'm not giving you your money back.
I keep it.
What's your angle?
Look, I've been running Find the Lady for years, and even I didn't catch that swap.
Mm-hmm. Where's your partner?
I left him.
Why?
I need an upgrade.
So, Mozzie not only recognizes Neil's talents, but he also recognizes an opportunity. And he proposes that they become partners. Now, this entire conversation and encounter, to me, inverts what I think we've been led to believe about their relationship. Prior to this, it seemed that Neil was the brains and the driver behind everything, and that Mozzie, while brilliant and knowledgeable, worked at the direction of Neil. In other words, Mozzie was the assistant working for Neil, so to speak. But in fact, what we see here is that Mozzie was the brains and the driver, and that Neil, although he was a flashy front man, was the assistant working for Mozzie. So Neil was the David Lee Roth to Mozzie's Eddie Van Halen, so to speak. During the conversation, Neil shows Mozzie the bonds that he's forged, and Mozzie is further impressed with Neil. Back in the present day, Neil says that Mozzie's long con proposal was the first time he'd heard the name Vincent Adler. Peter counters that it was the bonds that Mozzie had admired that were the first time Neil had come to Peter's attention.
Here's another one for you, Peter.
Snowboarding all the new cases, Bert.
Bond forgeries. Two phony Atlantic Incorporated bonds in 6 months.
2.5 a year?
Mm-hmm. Atlantics have never been forged.
I'll pass.
All right. This is quality work. I think this guy has a future.
This shows us one of the things that has probably been a factor in making Peter one of the top agents. The little details. He offered the case to another agent in the office with the comment, two phony Atlantic Incorporated bonds in 6 months. The other agent passed because it's only 2 and 6 months. He was looking at quantity. Peter was looking at the uniqueness and the anomaly because even though it was only 2 and 6 months, they had never been forged. And maybe there was some audacity that caught his attention too. Typically, you would think that a forger wouldn't want to call attention to their work. In fact, calling attention to one's work is to call attention to oneself. That's a good way to not only get on law enforcement's radar, but also to eventually get caught. You don't hide a forgery by making it something that is unique. The forger is typically going to forge things that are common. You don't hide a needle in a haystack, you hide it with other needles because it gets lost amongst the crowd. So by forging something that had never before been forged, Neil is essentially saying that his work is so good that he doesn't have to hide it amongst a flood of similar items. That's audacity. Now, despite the fact that at the time Peter had told the other agent that Neil's bond forgeries were good, in the present day he tries to convince Neil that they really weren't all that good. And of course, it wasn't just the other agent to which Peter had commented that Neil's bonds were good forgeries.
This guy's good.
What about this one's getting under your skin?
You really want to hear about this?
Well, of course, always.
All right.
Wow, that's a forgery?
The seal, the signature, the security strip. See, most forgers are only experts at one aspect. The man who forged this bond is capable of bigger things. He can do it all.
Well, so can you.
Lose the stash?
Yeah, sorry, Magnum. I still love you.
I love you too.
She doesn't seem to really have any significant input into this case. And perhaps she doesn't really provide any significant input on any of his cases early in his career. Nonetheless, she did express an interest in the case. I mean, after all, when Peter asked, do you really want to hear about this? Her immediate response was, well, of course, always. So even at this point, she was involved in his cases, even if only as a means of providing him a way to think out loud, so to speak. In the present day, Neil continues to tell Peter about himself, Mozzie, and Adler. And then in the past, we see Neil and Mozzie surveilling Adler. And in typical Mozzie fashion, he tries to be profound by misquoting a historic figure. The quote he gives is, "Know thine enemy and you will win," Sun Tzu. However, in the Wordsworth edition of 1997, that is not quite correct. Their translation is, "Know the enemy, know yourself. Your victory will never be endangered. Know the ground, know the weather. Your victory will then be total." The inclusion of knowing yourself as a prerequisite to victory is a significant factor and a difference that Mozzie omitted. Knowing your enemy is important in a battle, in a conflict, in a negotiation, whatever, but that's only half the battle. Knowing yourself is the other half, and it's a half too many people ignore or neglect, as Mozzie did here. Sun Tzu had another similar quote, which goes, "Know yourself and know your enemy. You will be safe in every battle. You may know yourself and not know your enemy. You will then lose one battle for every one you win. You may not know yourself or the enemy. You will then lose every battle." So it's not so much that Mozzie got the portion he quoted incorrect. It's more that he gives it out of context and as a result misrepresents the meaning of the original. Anyway, as Mozzie explained the con, Adler periodically sends money to the Caymans. If they had his account number and his password, they could reroute one of those transfers, but Adler keeps the information in his head. Neil's job was to get the information from Adler. Neil had responded, well, that would be impossible. Mozzie nearly correctly quotes Walt Disney in response, and he says, "It's fun to do the impossible." Close, but not 100%. The exact quote is, "It's kind of fun to do the impossible." The difference may not seem significant, but Mozzie's version is absolute. If you're doing the impossible, it's all happy, happy, joy, joy, and nothing else. In Walt Disney's version, there is sort of a tacit acknowledgement that while there can be fun in doing the impossible, there can also be not fun in doing the impossible. It allows not only for the presence of frustration, aggravation, drudgery, but it hints that maybe the fun is what comes at the end, after having persevered through the frustration, aggravation, and the drudgery. Anyway, Mozzie told Neil that the way to get the information was to become a trusted advisor to Adler, then persuade him to give up the information to Neil. And they would have about 5 months to get the information before the next transfer. And the first step was for Neil to meet and charm Adler at a charity dinner for the Antiquities Recovery Project. at the price of $5,000. But the only way Neil could afford that would be if he sold some of his counterfeit bonds. Back in the present day, Peter says that selling the bonds to finance Neil's entry into the charity dinner was the first mistake Neil made because it led to the first time the FBI saw Neil in person and not just as a phantom figure behind a bond forgery scheme. Neil defends the decision and the action by saying it was a calculated risk, but a risk worth taking for the con that they were about to run on Adler. Then he tries to turn the tables on Peter by saying that, as he recalls it, he wasn't the only one who made a mistake that day. Back in the past, we see that Neil met Mozzie outside the bank, Neil having just cashed out some of the forged bonds. Mozzie makes a comment about how the irony of the teller giving Neil a sucker would not be lost on Alanis Morissette, which is a joke somebody probably should explain to me, as I'm not familiar with Alanis Morissette's music, and I don't really know anything about her other than the fact that she's a singer. While Neil and Mozzie are having this exchange, they overhear part of somebody else's conversation.
What?
Shh. Brooks Brothers suit. Yes,
that means Fed. Talking to the bank manager.
So we gotta go.
I've never met a Fed before.
Let's keep it that way.
Excuse me. Sorry, I couldn't help but overhear. Are you with the FBI?
Special Agent Peter Burke.
Wow. I just took some money out of the bank and I heard you talking about counterfeiting.
Your money's safe. I'm looking after counterfeit bonds.
Well, I have some bonds at home. How would I know if they're not real?
I'm sure they're fine.
Well, thanks again for all the hard work you're doing, Agent Burke. That's for you. Have a good day.
Was this a mistake on Peter's part? I don't see how. Yes, now Neil knows Peter by sight and by name, and I guess that could be considered a mistake. But it really isn't Peter's job to hide from Neil. Neil learning Peter's identity was merely an incidental occurrence during the course of the investigation, and Neil knowing Peter's identity really didn't put any sort of major crimp into the investigation as far as I can see. Neil letting Peter see him and identify him was not just an incidental occurrence. It was a deliberate, arrogant, and bad decision on Neil's part, quite frankly. Part of his job as a con artist and a forger, if you want to call that a job, is to not get caught. Part of not getting caught is to not be identified. And it's a pretty safe bet that Peter immediately realized who Neil was, all because Neil couldn't resist showing off. If you remember back in the pilot episode, when Neil confronted Hagen, he told Hagen that he shouldn't have signed the bonds that Hagen was forging, and that he, Neil, was no stranger to vanity. I'd commented then that Neil signing the bonds that Peter had caught him on, presumably the same bonds from this episode, wasn't the vanity in question because, as was said in that pilot episode, Peter didn't know that Neil had signed them. So I think this is the vanity to which Neil referred in that pilot episode. Because walking up to Peter and letting himself be seen just to feel like he's putting one over on Peter, yeah, that's vanity. Back at the loft, Mozzie was scolding, quizzing, and advising Neil on various subjects, and he was also corking what Neil called a bargain red wine. Mozzie responded that Adler's wine list included a 91 Bordeaux that was corked in the wrong bottle at $800 a pop. I was not able to find any information on a 91 Bordeaux being corked in the wrong bottle. So was it, in fact, corked in the wrong bottle, or was it just a really bad vintage? Various websites call the 1991 Bordeaux wine atrocious, and it is deemed not worth buying. Severe spring frosts and below-freezing temperatures in mid-April had caused significant damage to vineyards, being the second coldest vintage ever recorded. Summer arrived, the weather picked up, but then extremely heavy rains struck in both September and October, which resulted in rot. Consequently, numerous estates declassified their 1991 Bordeaux wine, which seems to be the opposite of what Mozzie says, because being declassified means that the Bordeaux wines were essentially sold as seconds in bottles with other less prestigious labels on them, and it was not a case of a less prestigious wine being sold in a Bordeaux-labeled bottle. Well, Neil took the bottle that Mozzie had corked to the charity fair, then as Nick Halden gave the bottle to Adler and tried sucking up to him, first by complimenting him on his business acumen, and then by talking up one of Adler's paintings, Raphael's St. George and the Dragon, which we have encountered before as the painting he stole and that Sarah Ellis really wants to get back from him. After discussing art briefly, Adler introduced Neil to his assistant, Kate Moreau. Neil and Kate discussed art, and specifically St. George and the Dragon, which she said was her favorite, and which, of course, is an important fact that Neil wants to remember. After a bit, Kate realized that Neil was there to cozy up to Adler, as she put it, and said that since the seating chart had Neil nowhere near Adler, changing that was his first challenge. And then she left with her boyfriend. Neil slipped into the dining room, swapped seating cards so he could sit next to Adler, who, upon discovering this, seemed rather annoyed that his date had been relegated to the Buenos Aires table, as he said, and told Neil that he had but a few minutes to tell Adler what he wanted before he found himself removed. Or at least that was the implication. Neil said he wanted to work for Adler, but Adler was having none of it. Neil told Adler that a business that he was intending to buy would make a deal somewhere else, leaving Adler with egg on his face. Well, Adler had had enough. He had heard enough, and basically told Neil, get lost. But Neil said, here's my contact information. Call me when it all goes down, exactly as I said, and you realize I knew what I was talking about. And of course, Neil and Mozzie did know about the deal ahead of time, so of course, Neil looks like a genius. Adler ended up hiring Neil to find things for him to buy and to find out things about everyone that Adler was doing business with, which it turned out Neil was actually good at doing. In the present, Peter asks Neil if that was when he and Kate got together, but Neil says no, she had a boyfriend. But in spite of that, her and Neil's relationship was something more than mere co-workers.
Remind me again why I let you make my favorite necklace disappear.
Because you like magic.
Someday you're going to tell me all of your secrets. I mean it.
Maybe someday. Come out with me on Friday.
Michael asked me to move to Chicago with him.
Chicago? Are you gonna go?
I am in a month.
It's a big step.
Yeah, I know.
Well, you like Chicago. They have a great art museum and decent pizza. A little windy.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I need to get
back to work.
Well, that was awkward. Neil was clearly shaken by the news that Kate was moving away. But just as clearly, Kate seemed equally troubled, hesitant, sorry at having to tell Neil the news. I'm not sure exactly how to describe her feelings, but she obviously had a great reluctance in saying the thing out loud. Even though there was no indication that she and Neil had been anything other than co-workers, it definitely seems that Kate had been attracted to Neil, and maybe was just trying to ignore that. Maybe there had been a little bit of flirting going on. Maybe even some emotional cheating on her boyfriend with Neil, as evidenced by her saying, someday you're going to tell me all your secrets. That definitely does not seem to have been a reference to his skills as a sleight of hand artist. Then on top of all that, her boyfriend asks her to move to Chicago with him. Neil finally asks her out, and suddenly the reality of the situation hits her. She realizes that she was undeniably attracted to Neil. She's confronted by the conflict between choosing to be with her longtime boyfriend or stay with Neil. And maybe that's made even more significant if she realized that her relationship with her boyfriend had changed, and perhaps that change being as a direct result of her obvious attraction to Neil. I think that's the situation she's found herself in, and she's a bit shell-shocked, and she is visibly conflicted. Afterward, we see Adler showing Neil a fractal etched into a metal plate, and Neil told Adler about the person who had been digging around in his South American acquisitions. Neil had arranged for this individual to come meet with him under the pretext of a job interview. In walks Alex Hunter. After a bit of verbal sparring with Alex, Adler went on the attack. He didn't like anyone looking into his business interests or his personal interests, and he essentially threatened her. Not in so many words, but the implication was pretty clear. Back off or you'll regret it. After Alex left, Adler gave Neil a check as a reward. Nice. Presumably it was a big bonus and not just his regular salary. Neil persuaded Adler to let him invest, even though he didn't meet the minimum buy-in and Adler seemed to have a policy against his employees investing. We already know from the opening sequence that Adler was a con man. So the idea that Neil somehow convinced Adler to let him invest is itself probably a con. Adler didn't really need convinced. He was leading Neil to the con, and his faux reluctance was part of the con. After all, a willing victim is easier to cheat than a reluctant or unwilling victim. And by giving out generous bonuses, knowing that many of them would be coming back to him as so-called investments, he builds up goodwill and trust with his employees while losing comparatively little. And apparently Neil wasn't the only employee investing their earnings back into the company. In the present, he tells Peter that we all did. We all invested, presumably meaning all the employees. Neil didn't realize it was a scam. And besides, on paper, Adler was making them 14%. Additionally, the larger point was to prove his loyalty to Adler for the larger, more profitable goal of stealing the money transfer. Back in the past, Alex confronted Neil. When she seemed to try and blame him for her predicament, he says, something that really reflects the relationship between Peter and himself at that particular time. It's my job to catch you. It's your job not to get caught. Too bad for Neil he didn't consider that when he was outside the bank and walked up to Peter. Alex and Neil have a romp in the sheets, after which Alex revealed that she recognized Neil as a fellow grifter and that she was looking for something that Adler didn't have, but apparently wanted, was looking for, had information about, and that she had been pursuing for years, the music box. So, Alex took off, headed toward Copenhagen, where the box was rumored to be, and told Neil that if she ever needed his help, she would send him an origami lily as a message. But even though Alex was gone, Kate wasn't. She showed up at Neil's loft to tell him that she didn't go to Chicago, because Neil was not in Chicago. Meanwhile, Mozzie is getting a little antsy about Neil's lack of progress in getting the password to Adler's Cayman's account.
Adler makes the transfer on Friday, and you still haven't gotten the password yet.
I said I'll get it.
Oh, good, because I thought you were having second thoughts about abandoning your new town and country lifestyle. Don't kid yourself. Kate doesn't even know your real name. None of them do.
They care about me, okay? She cares about me.
No, she cares about Nick Halden, and he doesn't exist. Look, it's time to finish this job and move on.
I guess one of the dangers about a long con is getting caught up in the lie. I would imagine the same dangers exist for undercover law enforcement officers who stay undercover for extended periods of time. You spend so much time, so long, thinking and acting like some other person. In a sense, actually being some other person. And those around you build social and emotional connections to that person that they think you are. It's natural that at some point you would start to reciprocate those feelings and connections. It's human nature. It would have been easy for Mozzie to keep things in perspective because he was not the one in the thick of it. He was not the one who was living the lie all day, every day, month after month. What he told Neil was harsh, but it was the truth. It was the truth Neil needed to hear if he was to remain in touch with reality. Kate didn't know he existed. Although part of Neil undoubtedly came through in his Nick Halden persona, Kate didn't love Neil. She loved Nick. After this, Adler gifted Neil with an expensive suit. Without a doubt, Adler had benefited from Neil being on his staff, but the conversation shifted from the suit to other more personal things.
You and Kate have gotten close. You look good together. How's she feel about it?
There are things about me that I haven't told her.
I wouldn't worry. Oftentimes, the things we try and hide are the most obvious to the people around us. Don't sell yourself short. Kate will love you for who you really are. As will others.
If you read between the lines, the things we try and hide are the most obvious to the people around us. Kate will love you for who you really are. It's clear that Adler knew Neil was not who he was pretending to be, and that he was up to something. He may not yet have known what or how or who, but he knew. He knew something. He knew something was up. Of course, the fact that the newspaper with the FBI sketch of Neil was on his desk, meaning that even if he hadn't figured it out long before this, the sketch probably would have alerted him to it. And did Neil really think that Adler hadn't seen the sketch? He was probably betting, hoping really, that Adler hadn't seen it, but that seems a pretty far-fetched hope. In spite of the fact that Adler was hinting that he knew something was up, and in spite of the fact that the newspaper with Neil's sketch was on Adler's desk, Neil still makes his bid for the password. And it seemed to succeed. Adler wrote down what he said was the password to his account so that Neil could check the supposed irregularities in the Cayman's account. After Adler left Neil in the office, Neil grabs the newspaper. Well, if Adler hadn't seen the sketch before and wasn't already suspicious of Neil, the fact that the newspaper disappears might have caught his attention. It might have made him wonder why the newspaper disappeared and where he might have just overlooked or dismissed the sketch and the similarities to Neil, aka Nick Halden. The disappearance of the newspaper might have caused him to not overlook the sketch or dismiss the similarities. As illustrated in Poe's The Purloined Letter, sometimes it's better to leave well enough alone and in plain sight because the disappearance or absence of a thing can be more telling than its presence. Also, Neil stole Adler's hat. Neil and Kate had a talk in the park, and he said he felt like if he blinked, everything would be gone. I can't prove it, but I think this was at least in part due to Mozzie's comments about none of this being real, the lifestyle, Kate, all of it. I think Neil was starting to realize that after having won Kate with the lie that was Nick Halden, he could potentially lose her as Neil Caffrey because of the lies. And I think that scared him. Back in the loft, Mozzie was not happy. Neil told him that he didn't get the password. Now, we know that Adler wrote down what he said was the password and gave it to Neil. So we're kind of led to believe at this point that maybe Neil had gotten cold feet, that maybe he believed he could continue living the lie as Nick Halden, maybe with some minor changes, maybe while slowly revealing the truth, or at least enough of the truth to let him become himself again, but without revealing the con. Although Mozzie wasn't happy, he did seem resigned to the fact that Neil believed himself to be in love. And he quoted St. Augustine. Or more correctly, Neil attributed the quote to St. Augustine and Mozzie didn't correct him. Actually, Mozzie got the basic quote correct, although what he quoted was somewhat out of context and part of a much longer quote. And it wasn't St. Augustine. It was actually written by Louis de Bernier in his novel Corelli's Mandolin. And the full quote is this. Love is a temporary madness. It erupts like an earthquake and then subsides. And when it subsides, you have to make a decision. You have to work out whether your roots have become so entwined together that it is inconceivable that you should ever part. Because that is what love is. Love is not breathlessness. It's not excitement. It's not the promulgation of promises of eternal passion. That is just being in love, which any of us can convince ourselves we are. Love itself is what's left over when being in love has burned away. And this is both an art and a fortunate accident. Your mother and I had it. We had roots that grew toward each other underground. And when all the pretty blossoms had fallen from our branches, we found that we were one tree, not two. So as I said, Mozzie technically got the part of the quote that he recited correct, but the context was totally different. The meaning was totally different. It was much more significant than Mozzie presented it. That's a great quote. Well, the next morning, Neil and Kate were at the loft when the news came on to the television. Adler had disappeared. His investment business was a fraud, and everyone who invested with him lost everything. At the FBI, Peter also heard the news, and he was astounded that no one saw this coming. One of the agents made a comment, then introduces himself, Clinton Jones. He said he had only been around for a few months, but he was interested in getting onto the special white-collar task force that he had heard Peter was putting together. Although Peter said he couldn't promise anything, he had been impressed that it was Jones who originally put the Dutchman on the FBI's radar. Peter was further impressed when Jones recognized that the sucker Peter had in the evidence collection about Neil was the sucker that he'd gotten from Neil, codenamed James Bonds. And more importantly, Jones had recognized the significance of it. It represented unfinished business. This makes me wonder what happened to Jones. Here, he is sharp and insightful. It also means that he had been an agent for at least 8 years by the time we move to the present day, at least 7 at the time of the series pilot. So what happened? During the entire first season, he seemed more like a rookie, or someone who had only been an agent for a comparatively short time, rather than a seasoned agent. And had he been a relatively young agent, one could almost forgive his somewhat dull-wittedness in the first season. But as someone with 7-plus years in service, not so much. In the present day, Neil tells Peter that Adler had left a single dollar in the firm's accounts, and that the supposed password was a clever anagram for, "Nice try, Neil." As Neil had said, every con has an expiration date, and undoubtedly the expiration date on Adler's con was coming up. But my guess is that Neil's attempt to get the password to the Cayman's account led Adler to end his con maybe a little bit earlier than he originally planned. After all, the timing between Neil and Mozzie trying to con him, Neil trying to get the password, and his disappearance, Adler's disappearance, was just too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence. I also wonder about having left $1. Leaving $1, exactly $1, seems very specific. It doesn't seem reasonable that it would have been an accident. It had to be intentional. And surely it meant something, or was intended to mean something, but I don't know what. We saw Neil and Kate stressing about the situation. Kate more than Neil. Neil tried to reassure her that despite no money, no jobs, nothing, they would be okay, if for no other reason than they had each other. But of course, there's something that Neil needed to tell her about Nick Halden. After Neil told Kate the truth about himself, and she didn't bail on him, he undertook teaching her to survive. We saw them with Mozzie running a fake cop, fake evidence collection scam. We also saw the two of them in a scenario that Neil described in the pilot, sitting in their crappy apartment, drinking whatever cheap wine they had been able to afford, presumably out of the 82 Bordeaux bottle that they had put it in, pretending that they were living in the Côte d'Azur. But then Neil made a mistake.
Look, that FBI agent, Burke, he's been asking around about the British pounds. Maybe, maybe we should take some time away. Outside the FBI's range, we can start in Cap d'Antibes while it's still warm, work our way up to Paris, over to Amsterdam, then Copenhagen.
I'm not going to Copenhagen.
Okay, I should have mentioned Alex.
This isn't about Alex, Neil. You just tried to con me.
I don't believe it wasn't about Alex. At all. I think that the attempted con was probably the biggest part of it, but Alex probably is at least part of the reason for Kate's response. Because after all, the con wasn't just about the fact that Neil's reasons for suggesting the trip was the music box. It was also the fact that it was at Alex's summons. And no matter what she says, Kate can't possibly overlook the fact that Neil was lying to her and trying to con her for Alex. That has to make her question Neil's dedication to her. If he'll lie to her and con her for another woman, there's no reason to believe that he wouldn't cheat on her and lie to her about that too. Because after all, isn't that what cheating on your partner really is? Isn't it just another form of a con? Well, Neil tried to apologize to Kate, but to no avail. She left. Neil met with Alex. The two of them tried to steal the box, but it was a 3-person job. They needed Kate, but she wasn't there. And of course, we heard the rest of the story before about how Alex ended up in a French hospital, Neil barely escaped, and how everyone thought he had the music box, and he didn't bother to correct the story. When he got back to New York, Kate had disappeared. In the present, Neil admits that his schemes began to get bigger and probably more reckless. After all, he was trying to get Kate's attention through his schemes. Back in time, Peter was working with the team, tracking Neil across Europe, but their tracking was all about where he had been, not where he was or where he was going to be. Peter wanted to hear new ideas on how to track him, not the same old methods that were clearly not working. He pointed to a new agent, Diana Berrigan, and asked, "You're on the run. How do I catch you?" And she answered, "Stake out your girlfriend." After a bit of thinking out loud about Diana's comment, Peter realized that Neil was looking for Kate, but he didn't know where she was because she kept moving. But the FBI did know where she was. Next, we learned that Mozzie had shown up at Neil's loft with some news. Maybe Kate's location. Maybe not. It was questionable information from a highly unreliable source. But despite Mozzie's warning that it seemed like a trap, Neil didn't care. He insisted on knowing. So Mozzie gave him the information, despite his misgivings about the veracity of the information and the possible consequences. That information led Neil to a storage facility where Kate was keeping things secure. Neil saw her with the forgery of the Raphael that she loved, and of course, she commented that she had heard the real painting was stolen. So, yeah, Neil had gotten her attention. Neil tried to make amends, telling Kate that although he may have lied about many things, like being someone he wasn't, like trying to con their boss, that he did love her and he had never lied to her about that. Kate responded that she believed him, apparently accepting his apology and the penance that he had been performing by saying, yes, she loved him too. But then the first shoe dropped. When she asked how he had found her, he said that Mozzie had heard that she was fencing Mauritian penny stamps. Except that she wasn't. Not anymore. Then the other shoe dropped, as Peter and a team of FBI agents broke through the outer door of the storage facility to confront Neil. He was caught. Peter walked in and told Neil he was under arrest. Neil put out his hand and thanked Peter. And of course, Peter was confused. Thank you for what is probably what he was thinking. But Neil continued and clarified that by saying, I never would have found her without you. And as Neil says, we know the rest. In the present, Peter says that the key is to find Adler. Neil seems to think that there's no way to find him. It's not just that the trail has gone cold, it's that there is no trail. Was no trail. Peter reminds Neil that he was caught when Peter found out what he wanted most. And they know what Adler wants most, the fractal. But Peter doesn't quite believe that Neil is telling him the whole story. He picks up an origami piece, looks like it might have supposed to have been a crane or some similar sort of bird, and Peter tells Neil that he knows that Alex has been there. She's the only one he knows who is into origami, and the paper that it's made out of is a receipt with that day's date. Neil does seem a bit put out that Peter had figured it out. The look on his face clearly says that he didn't want to have to reveal the truth. But he realizes he doesn't have much of a choice. He says that Alex thinks it's supposed to be a fractal antenna, specifically for an emergency beacon based on the shape, which seems to correspond to a specific frequency used for such things. Peter follows the logic to the conclusion, but questions the conclusion by asking Neil if he's really saying that if they built a real antenna based on the fractal, and they hook it up to a radio, it would lead to something? Neil says, yep. It's going to lead them to a boat or a plane or something that disappeared in the 1940s. Peter does seem a bit astounded. After all, it seems incredible to believe that whatever the beacon leads to could be somehow worth killing two people for. Neil points out that Adler thinks it is. That doesn't mean that whatever is at the other end of that electronic rainbow is actually worth killing for. All that matters in the course of events is that Adler thinks it is, and that's what they have to deal with. And that's why they have to find whatever it is first, because as long as it's out there, as long as Adler doesn't have it, and as long as Adler thinks that he has a chance to get it, the lives of more people could be in danger. But it's still going to be out there for a while longer, because this is the end of that episode. I would like to remind you that you can visit the official website at www.whitecollaredpc.com, and there you will be able to see the show notes, which include links to all the resources I've mentioned and used in preparing this episode. You will find links to different ways that you can subscribe or follow this podcast, or your friends can do so if they're not already listening. And you will also find links to different ways that you can support the podcast financially. Thank you again for listening. And be sure and join me next time for the episode, What Happens in Burma? Until then, take care and God bless.